Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced in Toronto on the traditional territory of the Wendat, the Anishinaabe, the Haudenosaunee, Métis, and the Mississaugas of the New Credit. I'm your host, Ome Salma Rahimtula. This episode of Groundwire will look back at the significant stories from the second half of 2019. Here is your 2019 Year in Review, Part 2. First, some headlines from the second half of 2019. Our first headline is from CJLY Kootenai Co-op Radio on the Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, BC, about a new report on the overpriced of apartments for Canada's minimum wage earners. This headline was aired on Groundwire on August 19th.
A new study by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives reports that in nearly every Canadian neighbourhood studied, the hourly wage needed to rent an apartment is far above minimum wage and rising quickly. Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinaik's traditional territory in BC brings us the details in the following report.
A new study by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives reports that in nearly every neighbourhood studied, the hourly wage needed to rent an apartment is far above the minimum wage and rising quickly. The report, which is called Unaccommodating, maps rental affordability in neighbourhoods across Canada by calculating the rental wage, the hourly wage needed to afford an average apartment without spending more than 30% of one's earnings. Some findings of the report. One in four Canadians earns within $3 of their province's minimum wage. The national average wage needed to afford a two-bedroom apartment in Canada is $22.40 an hour, or $20.20 an hour for an average one-bedroom. Only 3% of the 795 neighborhoods studied allow for a full-time minimum wage worker to rent an average two-bedroom apartment without spending more than 30% of their income, and in only 9% of neighborhoods can they afford a one-bedroom. There are no neighborhoods in the Greater Toronto Area or Metro Vancouver where a full-time minimum wage worker could afford an apartment without paying much more than 30% of their earnings. You can download the report and look at the companion map on the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives website at www.policyalternatives.ca/unaccommodate.
Our next headline comes from the September 16th edition of Groundwire about a new report on the Indigenous suicide crisis, produced by Greg McDougall of Equitable Education.
Statistics Canada published research earlier this summer that provides a deeper understanding of the Indigenous suicide crisis than was previously available. Overall, First Nations had a suicide rate 3 times that of non-Indigenous Canadians, while Inuit had a rate 9 times as high, and Métis 2 times as high. Indigenous youth and young adults had the highest rates. Inuit had rates of 23.9 times as high and First Nations 6.2 times as high as non-Indigenous Canadians, also in the 15 to 24 age range. Mohan Kumar was the lead researcher on the report.
While these look like just numbers, there is a person behind them, and their death meant an incredible loss to family, friends, community, and the society at large.
The report analyzed how 5 socioeconomic factors, education, employment, income, marital status, and location, connect to a larger amount of the disproportionality in suicide rates. It also found that for First Nations, the suicide rate is 2 times as high for those living on reserve as for those off reserve. There is much more to this story. The most important part being that some appropriate response to this crisis is needed. The report's findings are covered in more detail at National Observer, equitableeducation.ca, or at the StatsCan website itself. Credit to Greg McDougall of equitableeducation.ca.
Next up, a headline from our October 7th edition of Groundwire on the government's appeal ruling on the labeling of West Bank-made wine as a product of Israel. This headline was produced by Michael Welch of CKUW.
On Friday, September 6th, Canada's Attorney General filed a notice saying it would appeal a Canadian federal court ruling that wines made on occupied Palestinian land should not be labeled a product of Israel. The July 29th ruling determined that such labels were false, misleading, and deceptive, thereby restricting the ability of Canadians to express their political views on Middle East politics through their consumer choices. Winnipeg-based activist David Kattenberg applied for the judicial review after having complained to the Canadian Food Inspection Agency about settlement wine discovered on a Canadian liquor store shelf being labeled product of Israel. Kattenberg believes the federal government's defense of Israel's mislabeling of its settlement wines has implications for its commitment to the rule of international law.
Canada doesn't accept the annexation of Golan Heights, but Canada is happy to accept Golan Heights wines on Canadian store shelves, extend favorable tariff treatment to Golan Heights wines, and defend the right of Israel to label Golan Heights wines product of Israel. It's hypocritical, it's duplicitous, and it's illegal. Because it constitutes, you know, aid and support for the commission of crimes that are considered war crimes.
Kattenberg expects the appeal will go forward sometime in early 2020. He's optimistic the case will survive this appeal, though the federal court could still appeal it to the Supreme Court. From Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg-Aking, the homeland of the Métis Nation and historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Our final headline aired on December 3rd and looks at the exploitation of immigrant workers in Montreal, produced by Stephen Christoph.
In Côte de Neige, the Immigrant Workers Center released a report on work conditions within Montreal's warehouse sector, which particularly hires new immigrants and low-income people. Joey Kulugai of the Immigrant Workers Center.
One of the major things that workers were pointing out was dangerous work conditions, the situations where they can get injured. Given that situation, also the lack of responsibility of the companies to equip them with proper health and safety equipment. Companies who hire through temp agencies, like for instance the Dollarama warehouse, who hires almost 95% of their workforce inside the warehouse through agencies. They wash their hands from that type of responsibility.
This is Stefan Christoph reporting for Groundwire.
You are tuned in to Groundwire Year in Review, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your local community radio station. Now we look back at some features from the second half of 2019 on Groundwire. Our first feature is from August 5th, when the Coalition Avenir Québec successfully passed the Racist Bill 21, restricting Muslim women with hijabs and other religious symbols from working in the public service. Since the passing of the law, rights groups have sought leave at the Supreme Court of Canada to hear their case on the unconstitutionality of the bill and the harm it is causing. The feature was produced by Amy Lloyd and Gao Mahadevan of CKUT in Montreal on the traditional territory of the Mohawk peoples.
Coalition Avenir Quebec's Bill 21 went into effect on June 16, 2019. The bill, referred to as an act preventing the laicity of state, prevents public workers in positions of authority from wearing religious symbols. It also prevents people from receiving public services with their faces covered. The laws will most seriously curtail the freedoms of Muslim women who wear the hijab, Jews who wear the kippah, and Sikhs who wear turbans. Bill 21 invokes the notwithstanding clause of the Canadian Constitution, preventing citizens from challenging the law for violating fundamental rights and freedoms protected by the Canadian Charter. CQUT's Amy Lloyd spoke to Mei Chu, a Montreal-based lawyer, activist, and spokesperson, active in resisting the bill. Chu, a member of the Progressive Chinese of Quebec, recently organized a fast with other protesters to highlight how Bill 21 will impact the employment of religious minorities.
In response to Bill 21, you and others partook in a series of fasts. What was the catalyst behind this decision?
I think one of the catalysts was the refusal to accept that we had no recourse over the passing of one of the most discriminatory and the most Islamophobic law in North America. By using the notwithstanding clause, the government took away charter protection for religious minorities. I would even go as far as to say that Bill 21 is a fascist bill because not only does it deprive minorities of equal rights protection, but it also provides for a scheme of surveillance and sanctions against people for being religious minorities. The orientation of the CAC is an extension of the ADQ. they're riding on insecurities of the majority of the population who feel like they are losing their identity, who have suffered 15 years of neoliberal cuts from the previous Liberal government. And so people who are vulnerable are looking for scapegoats. And so the CAC handed them a scapegoat. It's a way to detract the majority from the real issue.
Less than 24 hours after it became law, several civil liberty groups filed a constitutional challenge to the act hours after it was enacted, and with it, asked the court for an urgent interim response to suspend the act's operation. The National Council of Canadian Muslims, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, and Itrak Noorel Haq, a Université de Montréal education student who wears a hijab, are listed as plaintiffs in the case. Honorable Justice Yurgo of the Quebec Superior Court denied the request to suspend operation of the act, stating that it failed to demonstrate that the act would cause harms to those affected, nor that it required urgent interim response. Mustafa Farouk of the National Council of Canadian Muslims has this to say.
We disagree that the harm is hypothetical. As was discussed today at our press conference by Amrit Fire from the World Sikh Organization, she is a student who just graduated from education and she would have been able to become a teacher. But now under Bill 21, she can't become a teacher. So the harm isn't hypothetical for her. It's very, very real. And that is the same for many folks right now in Quebec. And we also believe that this stay has to be dealt with in an urgent fashion. In terms of what we're going to keep doing, we're going to keep doing what we've always been doing. We're going to obviously, we'll wait for the Quebec Court of Appeal, you know, whether they want to grant our application for leave. But we're always going to be engaging in conversation with our Quebec neighbors. We're going to be, you know, the folks, our NCCM folks in Montreal are going to continue to go and outreach, have coffee, have tea, talk about the real impacts that pieces of legislation like Bill 21 have on them personally. It's really important for folks to understand, even as, you know, governments frame this piece of legislation as, you know, creating a more neutral state, that it's very clear that a neutral state doesn't discriminate.
As of August 1st, the plaintiffs were granted leave to appeal Justice Yurgo's decision. With this decision, the Quebec Court of Appeal has agreed to revisit the question of suspending the operation of the Laïcité law. Reporting for Groundwire, that was CKUT's News Collective.
Our next feature comes from Michael Welsh from CKUW, featuring a press conference where the sons of recently deceased Grassy Narrows chief Simon Forbister called on the government to keep their promises made to Northwestern Ontario's First Nations communities. This story was aired on Groundwire on November 4th.
For our final feature, we provide a report on a press conference which took place at the Steelworkers Hall in downtown Toronto on Monday, October 28th, in which the sons of recently deceased Grassy Narrows Chief Simon Forbister called on the re-elected Trudeau government to make good on commitments made 2 years ago and during the recent election campaign to build and operate a Mercury Care home in the Northwestern Ontario First Nations community. Grassy Narrows has for the past half century been suffering as a result of 10 tons of mercury from a Dryden, Ontario paper mill, which had been dumped into the English and Wabigoon River systems. According to a team of Japanese researchers led by Masanori Hanada, 90% of the people of Grassy Narrows and Wabasimoong First Nation show signs of mercury poisoning. In his first public statement since the late chief's death, son Leroy Forbister spoke at the conference about his father's commitment to getting the Mercury home built and of the importance of this facility to community members and Canadians generally.
Yeah, he was a very strong advocate, and he was right with it, with wanting to have the building done for the community. And with this building, what Mercury would do, it would make us get a bit more advanced on mercury study, and also the Canadians would understand from us too, from a little bit of like our advanced technologies, whatever that could come out of it, that they can learn from this building that we're trying to build. So in the future, that's, I'm really hoping we can get this thing done, because it should should be kept as a promise of what Trudeau has said.
Current Chief Rudy Turtle ran as an NDP candidate in the federal riding in which Grassy Narrows is located. He ended up losing in the last federal election to a 21-year-old rookie candidate running for the Conservative Party. Chief Turtle spoke about the promise made to the community by the Prime Minister.
A few years ago, Dean Philpott promised a mercury treatment center to the people of Grassy Narrows, and we've been pursuing that these past few years. We've been negotiating with the Government of Canada. Our negotiations have stalled due to differences in the funding amounts and also in the design. Justin Trudeau clearly said that money is no objection to building a treatment center at Grassy Narrows First Nation. Should he back down, then that means he lied right in front of everybody, right? Lied in front of Canada, and we will hold him accountable for his words.
Bill Phobister, a revered elder in the community, also ailing from mercury poisoning, elaborated on the need to build the facility sooner rather than later.
It's quite an expense to visit our relatives who are sick with mercury poisoning. So with having a home in our community would be ideal, because we would be able to help and be with our family who are contaminated by mercury poisoning. Now, as I speak, a lot of our youth are dying. You know, there's young men who died of stroke, heart attack, you name it. And also more recently now, the babies are being affected. A couple of our babies have passed on. So I really hope that Trudeau will keep his word. A promise is something very delicate to us. If someone promised to us, we believe the person. And that should be made clear to our leader today. There's a high water arising right now, and more of that mercury will filter into the Wabagoon River system once again. We have warned them before that. What if something, an outflow of that?
Listeners can get more details about the community's ongoing efforts to realize the new center with background on the tragedy by visiting the site freegrassy.net. Audio from that report was obtained from the Free Grassy Facebook page.
Our final feature aired last month on December 16th and looks at the 20th anniversary of the anti-World Trade Organization protests that took place in Seattle, Washington in 1999.
November 30th through December 3rd marked the 20th anniversary of the Battle of Seattle, the 1999 protests by tens of thousands that shut down the World Trade Organization meetings. Chris Dixon, an activist based in Ottawa, was one of the Direction Action Network activists involved in helping to organize those protests, as well as a 20th anniversary website, shutdownwto20.org. This is from an interview with Dixon by Mandy Hiscox of Radio Perg on CFRU.
Some of us who had helped to co-found the Direct Action Network started a conversation earlier this year about the 20th anniversary and about what we might want to do to commemorate that. Even on the left, among activists, there's like lots of very kind of mythologized understandings of what went down there. And part of our perspective is that there are plenty of people who want to tell the story on our behalf. But we thought what we could do was pull together some of the reflections and histories that people who were themselves directly involved in organizing the mass direct action could share. And some of those are ones that people wrote a long time ago, and some of those are ones that people have written very recently. We thought it would be useful to put them all in one place and also try to write out a more detailed history of what the organizing looked like and what the day-to-day protests themselves looked like, trying to sort of put aside many of those myths that circulate around Seattle. And then we also really wanted to talk about looking forward. So not just looking back 20 years, but also looking forward 20 years into the future and thinking about how do we anticipate what's going to occur in the next two decades? How do we plan for it in our movements? And what kinds of movements are on the rise right now? you know, that we can take heart from and that we can actively participate in. Because, yeah, we weren't interested in a project of nostalgia, you know, like we weren't interested in sort of sitting around and congratulating ourselves as veterans of this one particular episode, because we see ourselves as part of an ongoing struggle, right? Like, you know, I always appreciated the fact that the CLAC in Montreal, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, which was one of the central organizing groups for the protests against the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or the Organization of American States Summit in 2001 in Quebec City, they had this slogan that they used, which was, "It didn't start in Seattle and it won't end in Quebec City." And I think that that really crystallized something that's remained important for us, which is recognizing that when we mobilized for Seattle, we didn't come from out of nowhere. We were building on so much previous movement experience, and it didn't end, right? Like, we're continuing on into various kinds of movements and struggles today that, you know, certainly have changed in form, but I think a lot of the spirit has remained the same. And we really wanted to try and say that these are some of the things that we experienced and learned from Seattle that can maybe be useful now, and including mistakes. And we also really wanted to foreground some of the brilliant kinds of art that were involved in it, whether that was music. You know, there was, you know, there was like an anarchist marching band called the Infernal Noise Brigade that was just brilliant. And so we have some, you know, material up there about that, or some of the like music and video that was produced, particularly through the Seattle Independent Media Center, you know, that was its own, like there's a whole story just to be told about the birth of the independent media center movement in Seattle, and the ways that they, you know, put forward this whole kind of activist journalism approach.
The following is a clip of Jill Friedberg at the Seattle Independent Media Center from the Showdown in Seattle video series produced during the 1999 protests.
We've also started talking about using this model and trying to go elsewhere in the country and the world and help people kind of set up similar center so that there really could be an alternative media network around the world.
Friedberg went on to produce the documentary about Seattle, This Is What Democracy Looks Like, and the indie media network did go global, including a number of locals in Canada. 20th anniversary of the Seattle 1999 WTO protests were marked with a number of large gatherings internationally. Media activists from Canada presented at the Our Media Conference in Brussels, Belgium. Gretchen King on Indie Media and Sandra Jepson on the Media Action Research Group, and the Indie Media 20th Anniversary Encuentro in Houston, Texas. The website, produced by Direction Action Network members and GAIN, is at shutdownwto20.org. Thanks to Greg McDougall of equitableeducation.ca in Ottawa on unceded Algonquin territory, and to Mandy Hiscox of CFRU in Guelph on the traditional territory of the Neutral Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and Métis peoples for providing files for that report.
You are listening to Groundwire's 2019 Year in Review, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your local community radio station. Finally, our community radio report from December 3rd. The report looks at the Ontario court ruling that found the quote-unquote student choice initiative as unlawful. The initiative would have let college and university students opt out of fees that are essential to the survival of campus community radio stations across the province. This report was filed by Michael Welsh of CKUW.
Groundwire has reported extensively on the student choice initiative introduced by the Ford government, which would have allowed post-secondary students to opt out of paying fees for campus services, including campus radio stations. The anticipated shortfall in revenues would have crippled stations in universities across the province. On November 21st, a major legal victory was scored, which is station managers throughout Ontario breathing a sigh of relief. The Ontario Divisional Court panel ruling on the application by the Canadian Federation of Students and York Federation of Students concluded that the Ontario Minister of Training, Colleges and Universities had acted without statutory authority when implementing the Student Choice Initiative. Randy Reid is the CEO and General Manager of Campus Station Vibe 105 and VX3 Exchange in Toronto and serves as the Vice Chair for the National Campus and Community Radio Association. He explained to Groundwire what was at stake in this court challenge.
Since the Ford government announced the Student Choice Initiative, it kind of sent our members reeling all across the province. Basically, a lot of our members were unable to plan their budgets for the upcoming year. They were forced to have to look at letting go staff or reducing staff allocations in anticipation of having little to no levy to lean on. The levy relationship that campus community radio stations have had across the country for decades now, over 30 years strong, there's never been all-out reversal of that type of relationship in our history. If nothing was reversed, we have about 18 stations in Ontario, we would have lost about a third in the first year, and we're still looking at the potential of a loss of two or three. We would have lost two-thirds by the third year, and it would have been hard for the balance to maintain anywhere beyond 5 years.
Tina Plank is the station manager at Lakehead University-based CILU in Thunder Bay, Ontario, in Robinson Superior Treaty Territory and on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Métis. She expressed relief at the decision and shares what an unfavorable ruling might have meant for her station and for the community in which it was situated.
Our student levy made up close to about 70% of our operating budget, which was pretty much 100% payroll. And we had to look at that, and we were already operating on absolute minimal staff, which meant in the light of funding changes, we would have to completely change our staff model. And we didn't have a lot of room to do that. So it sent a lot of panic to our team. So we'd be looking at losing a full-time staff member. And the only option for the remaining staff member, myself, would also be not to work there. Because it's so difficult to kind of keep the level of programming and training and that the community and the students have come to know from LU Radio when you are using a staff model of one person. I'm just going to go say it's not possible. But to make that an actual model based on the cuts that we endured because of the Student Choice Initiative would essentially cripple the station and the future of it.
Have you been able to retain anything that might make things better for your station moving forward? Any lessons learned?
We took a look at our sort of staff workload, and we thought right off the get-go, let's just do a huge push, let's train a whole bunch of new people, let's get some new radio shows. So inadvertently, that kind of lit a little bit of fire under us, and now we're seeing a large surplus of students coming in to do radio shows, some new community members we're welcoming.
Would you say this was a wake-up call for community radio in Canada? And if so, what lessons has the NCRA learned as a consequence?
Right. So definitely one of the things that we're looking at the NCRA level is ways of supporting our membership with services and strategies that go beyond the traditional relationships that we've had with fundraising and with levy disbursement from our partners at the university level. At the NCRA level, we're looking at a lot of enterprise models that we can lean on. As we kind of face this whole world of digital transformation, we're looking at ways in which our member stations can utilize technology to better service their communities in a broader way.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire's Year in Review, covering stories from the second half of 2019. We thank all of our amazing contributors this year and look forward to more community radio news in 2020. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.